They are elected by you. I am elected by you. I'm constrained as they are constrained by a system that our founders put in place.
The founders separated power because they knew it was the best way to protect our citizens.
They didn't want one person, one man to have all the power like a king.
We show by our work that free people can govern themselves.
You can't pay lip service to the Constitution without obeying it.
Keep your eye on the ball. Structure is destiny.
This is Necessary and Proper, the podcast of the Federal Society's Article 1 Initiative. All views expressed on this podcast do not necessarily reflect those of the Federal Society. Hi, this is Nate Kaczmarek with the Article 1 Initiative. Today's episode features part 2 of our recent program on founding principles as pillars of our foreign policy. Following Congressman Mike Gallagher's remarks, we welcome the perspectives of Professor Henry Now, who is the Professor of Political Science and International Affairs at the Elliott School of International Affairs at George Washington University, Ilya Shapiro, who is a Senior Fellow in Constitutional Studies at the Cato Institute, and Professor Jeremy Rapkin, who is a professor of law at the Antonin Scalia Law School. The panel covered a wide range of foreign policy topics and discussed the modern Congress's role. Please send us your thoughts and feedback.
Professor Now, the floor is yours.
Great, thank you very much. You know what they say about 10 minutes in Washington. You'll never have a chance to be understood, but you may say enough to be indicted. So with that risk in mind, let me take a little bit of a lofty view for a moment of sort of the foreign policy traditions that we have in this country and how they inform our current debate. Because I think it's interesting that these foreign policy traditions, like our political parties, originated in the constitutional era. That is, in the period of the 1790s up through, let's say, the end of the War of 1812. The country was doing something that had never been done before. We forget that. We were trying to create a large country, relatively large country, based on a self-governing republic. And we were going to try to do that without a monarch, without a state church, without even a common history, because for the most part, the colonies had related directly, more directly to England than they had to one another. And we were going to do that in the middle of a world that was at war. This was the Napoleonic Wars throughout the 1790s and the early 1800s. It was an incredibly enormous task, frankly, and we succeeded, and we continue to succeed. Out of that first decade came essentially three of our foreign policy traditions, and a fourth one which came a little bit later, but it was already evident in the 1790s. First, the nationalist position, which is the position that George Washington took, essentially saying, look, stay out of foreign entanglements, take care of yourself, others will take care of themselves, take advantage of our unique geopolitical circumstances. We're far separated from Europe and its wars. By the way, an advantage which still pertains today in the sense that we occupy an hemisphere, the only hemisphere where we don't have a great power rival. All other great powers have rivals in their respective hemispheres. Do things unilaterally if you can. That's much better than trying to act multilaterally. And generally trade with countries. Nationalists urge us to trade with countries, but always be sure you get the best deal. The nationalist is focused on the relative gains from trade, not the absolute gains. And somebody always does gain a little bit more from any deal. In that sense, Trump's right. You win, you lose. But it's only with respect to the relative gains. There are obviously absolute gains that benefit everyone. The realist position emerged in this period, as the congressman already alluded to in Alexander Hamilton, his desire to align with Great Britain, the Jay Treaty, which caused a lot of controversy in that first decade. Hamilton's idea was that, you know, a republic is really no different from a monarchy. We have to deal in the world the way it is. We have to accept reality. And you deal with great powers. That's how you survive. And so he was eager to deal with the United Kingdom. He didn't believe you could change the international system, even as we were trying to change the nature of domestic politics. We had to operate through alliances, and that the best we could achieve was security and stability. We should not try to transform the world. You trade, but you trade only with allies from the realist perspective. Now, the internationalists disagreed with all that, represented most importantly in the early period, by the way, by Thomas Jefferson. He argued that republics were different. They were more peaceful, and their foreign policy had to be a product of their domestic regimes. So his focus was on the domestic, the nature of the domestic regimes, and the conflicts that evolved because of these differences. He believed that he wanted to spread, really, republicanism. And that's most evident in his attitude towards the territories that were acquired through the Louisiana Purchase. He wanted them to be independent, if possible. Not necessarily annexed to the United States, as long as they had similar republics, as long as they had similar forms of government and similar customs. So he made the comment that with respect to territories that or states that might emerge in the territories, keep them in the Union if it be for their good, but separate them if it be better. It was a very different view, by the way, of the Western territories than Hamilton had, who wanted to go out, conquer them, annex them, bring them into the Union. So Jefferson genuinely believed you could change the system, and you could do it by preserving national sovereignty because you would spread republicanisms. You would create more republics. He was obviously very excited by the French Revolution early on, obviously became disillusioned with the French Revolution later. He expected rivalry, therefore, with authoritarian states. Most of the rest of the world was authoritarian states. He believed that you had to arm yourself in order to defend yourself in that kind of world. So there's this element of armed diplomacy in Jefferson's idea of conservative internationalism. He fought our first war by sending the entire Navy to the Mediterranean. Kind of a silly, not a very smart move from a national security point of view because our borders were then exposed. But this is how strongly he believed in, putting muscle behind your diplomacy, in this case against the Barbary pirates. Now, a fourth form of internationalism came along somewhat later under Woodrow Wilson, the so-called liberal internationalists. They simply asked the question of, we're not just interested in a republic at home. We'd like to eventually someday establish a republic internationally. So what would that look like globally? And, of course, Wilson gave us his vision in League of Nations. Roosevelt gave us that vision of the United Nations. The idea was universality. Everyone would participate. Peaceful. Not armed diplomacy, that is, a lot of procedures that you would follow in the Charter and in the Covenant and so on in order to resolve issues. And you would use force only as a last resort because that could only disrupt negotiations and diplomacy. Now, these four traditions are still very much alive today. They actually inform our debate. We have institutes around the town dedicated to these different traditions. So they're hardly irrelevant, any less so than our political parties are irrelevant. It shows sort of the staying power of that earlier constitutional period. I think what we're seeing today is we're seeing a movement away from the internationalist positions, both conservative and liberal, the conservative internationalist positions of George W. Bush, who wanted to spread democracy everywhere at once, or so it seemed, the liberal internationalist tradition of Obama, who wanted to stake everything on diplomacy and didn't want to use the military playbook because he felt it would just simply make your diplomacy more difficult, a swing away from those internationalist positions to a more nationalist and realist position. Now, I have my preferences in terms of these traditions, and I've written about conservative internationalism, it's not my cup of tea that we've moved in this direction, but I do think there is an opportunity here, and that what is happening in terms of the resurgence of nationalism and realism is not necessarily all that inappropriate, given the times. Now, why do I believe that? One very important point is the world today is very different from the world of either the 1920s or certainly the world of the 1790s. Today, we have a world of mostly democratic nations. All of the industrialized worlds are democratic nations. It's a very different world from the one that existed earlier. And in that kind of a world, nationalism, it seems to me, especially coming from liberal societies, has more to do with kind of establishing the accountability of global developments and global institutions, and much less to do with the possibility of disrupting international affairs and once again creating an atmosphere that might lead to war, as nationalism did in the 1920s. So I think nationalism is not inappropriate in the present circumstance. And the nationalists are trying to tell us something very important, namely that we can't carry the burden that we have for the past 75 years for another 75 years. We now have strong allies. They should do more. And we should expect them to do more. Now, nationalists would like to pull back much more so than realists. So I'm glad that there's a realist component to the contemporary consensus, because they stress the importance of preserving our alliances and making sure that we at least preserve democracy where it currently exists, or preserve the alliances, the balance of power, where it currently exists. So the realists are interested in preserving NATO and our allies, our alliances in Asia. And I think Trump reflects some of these instincts as well, because he's doing that. He's actually strengthening those alliances while at the same time maintaining or trying to maintain reasonably good relations with the great powers, with China and Russia, which he knows are the ones that you have to work with if you're going to solve some of these problems like Ukraine or Korea. Now, I wish, obviously, that the internationalists were more involved. I love the speech that Trump gave in Poland, and I wish he would make that kind of a speech again and again. Coming out of the Reagan White House, you can understand why. But maybe it's not necessary. Maybe the internationalists can take a breather at this point, and I'm one of them, so I say to the internationalists, maybe we can relax at this point. The most important thing we need to be concerned about is preserving the democratic world, the new democratic world, which enables a more nationalist and realist response in the current atmosphere. We don't need to expand democracy or to expand trade. We do need to preserve what we have. Bilateralism, by the way, may be a good move for negotiating some changes in our trade agreements. It's going to make it difficult, however, to multilateralize those changes. And I think as an internationalist, I'm very concerned about how we're going to do that. Maybe it's better for us to get a little better deal bilaterally with each country, but somehow we're going to have to mesh those together into a multilateral framework, or we're going to lose one of the very important props, it seems to me, of the new democratic world that we have created. And finally, our objective, it seems to me, needs to be to not preserve democracy where in the major areas where it exists, that is Europe and Asia. In my judgment, therefore, Ukraine and Korea are really the key issues. We should probably move to a more offshore kind of defense policy or defense strategy in more remote regions. I'm thinking of Middle East, Southwest Asia, Southeast Asia, North Africa. That is, there defeat terrorism, but get in and out as quickly as possible. Maybe staying no more than 2 or 3 years. We should have learned from these long wars that the public has a very limited tolerance for them. And if you aren't out in 3 or 4 years, you're going to pay in the long run. And I'm hoping, of course, that today we're not going to pay in the long run for our policies in Afghanistan and Iraq, but they are largely responsible for this nationalist, realist reaction. So in any case, I leave it with that, that we can, I think, support a lot of what is going on, because it is okay in a major, in the new democratic world for nationalism to rebound a bit, that there are realists involved in the contemporary consensus that are worried about protecting and preserving democracy where it has developed. You don't want to lose that new democratic world. And the big outlying issue for me, I think, is still the trade question, because that is a very important prop, as I've suggested, of the new international world, the new democratic world, and it should be preserved. Okay, that's enough, I'm sure. Maybe 15 minutes, I say, well, all right, it's enough to indict me, I'm sure, but we'll get to that in the question and answer period.
Well, I'll try to take less time because I'm grateful for the invitation to appear here. I feel like I'm one of these things is not like the other. I am not a distinguished professor of foreign policy or even the law of foreign policy. I'm a simple constitutional lawyer. And indeed, I don't even have a PhD like Congressman Gallagher in international relations. My terminal degree there is a master's, and that year I think I spent most of my time either playing rugby with the beer drinking team or drinking beer with the rugby teams, depending on how you look at it. Well, look, as a simple constitutional lawyer, I said as we were preparing for this panel that I was going to respond to what the congressman had to say and then play the role of the libertarian foil, which is, I imagine, why I was invited. I generally agree with everything that that Mike Gallagher had to say. Most of it was not didn't really touch on legal issues, whether relating to the founders' conception of the Constitution or otherwise. But he did mention one thing that I think was very important, which is the jumping-off point for what I want to talk about, and that's that he said that we have overempowered the executive in foreign policy. I agree with that, although even there, that's not so much a legal issue. It's not a matter of the executive doing things necessarily that are unconstitutional or beyond that branch's constitutional prerogatives, but that Congress, as in almost every other area of policy, has refrained from protecting its own prerogative. And that's, I guess, why the Federalist Society has the Article I initiative. I mean, it's strange for someone from Cato to say that Congress should have more power, but of course, I'm not saying this in a vacuum. I'm saying this in a way to rebalance everything. In the context of foreign policy, I am not, as one might expect from kind of a caricature of a libertarian, saying that Congress has to look over the executive shoulder and approve every troop movement or missile fired or anything like that. I think it's too simplistic to read, for example, the declare war clause as saying anytime the president wants to use force, Congress has to legislate that or approve it. Nor that the only exception to that is when there's an immediate invasion and you can't get Congress involved and it's an emergency, that sort of thing. But neither, on the other hand, do I think it's right that the president can just do whatever he wants with his army as commander-in-chief. Regardless of for good, bad, or no reason at all. That can't possibly be right, that it's simply the executive, except for ratifying treaties, confirming ambassadors, regulating international commerce, and raising armies, the enumerated powers of Congress under the under Article I. So how do you strike that balance between the president, the executive, can never act without a formal declaration of war, which is different than making war? There were debates at the Constitutional Convention about whether to phrase that as the power to declare war or to make war, and they settled on declare. So I think it's again, too simplistic to say that Congress has to approve everything. But at the same time, it's not that the president gets to do whatever he wants. Or in other words, to put it in terms that our former president might use, I think it's a false choice between, say, Ron Paul and Bill Kristol or Lindsey Graham or whoever your kind of opposite sides of the spectrum on foreign policy might be. And that's the same thing as you answer the legal question as well. So let's look at what the law might be able to say on the use of force or the conduct of foreign policy. And most foreign policy, hopefully, is actually not the use of force. It is precisely having that big stick in order that you not use it. President Reagan, for example, used force three times, which I think was what President Obama did monthly, and who was regarded as the hawk, who was regarded as the dove. That's simple politics. So to preserve peace, sometimes you have to have that big stick. But anyway, if we care about the original public meaning of the Constitution, right, then what did what does our document say in terms of that separation of powers, in terms of rebalancing Article 1 versus Article 2? John Locke, to go back to, and Montesquieu, two influential philosophers on the founders, John Locke talked about the executive power and the federative power. And the federative power regarded war and peace, leagues and alliances, and transactions with persons and communities without the Commonwealth. Montesquieu, right, who's known as the father of the separation of powers and all the dry constitutional architecture, talked about there's the legislative power, then there's the executive in respect to things dependent on the law of nations, and then the executive in regard to matters that depend on civil law. So in separating the powers, there was a separate executive power over foreign policy. We see the same thing from Hamilton, from Jefferson, for that matter. You think that Jefferson might be more, less about a strong executive, but he talked about the transaction of business with foreign nations as executive altogether. Madison, even though he had that debate with Hamilton, the famous Helvidius versus Pacificus letters back and forth, you can look up that fascinating stuff. When Madison was not writing under pseudonym, however, he was much more favorable about executive power over foreign affairs. There were certain imbroglios about the recognition of France and disputes about whether Washington correctly proclaimed neutrality in the European wars and things like that. But even Madison, when he was proposing in Congress setting up the original Department of Foreign Affairs, what became the State Department, said that the Secretary of State was to conduct the business at the direction of the President, which is different than the language for setting up the Treasury Department, which was to act at the behest of Congress and report to Congress and things like this. So I think the vision of a strong executive, that is, that the executive has broad prerogative, you see that in the very first line of Article 2. The executive power is vested in the president, not the powers, the legislative powers herein granted, which are the prelude to the enumeration of Congress's legislative powers, but the executive power with certain carve-outs to make sure that there are checks. So it's not an absolute monarchical power. There's still the ones that I mentioned, treaties, ambassadors, international commerce, raising armies, and importantly, the power of the purse. And that's what leads me into my concluding thought. Where does that leave us? What should we do now? And if Congress does want to reassert itself in this area, how do we reconcile that with these readings from the founding era that I said? Well, first of all, the readings from the founding era are of course instructive, but we care about public meaning, not intent of the founders. So, and the Constitution, as I said, is pretty silent on this as to what the executive power is. And so I think here on the law, as on the policy of foreign affairs, we have to act out of prudence rather than some sort of first principle, in the sense that if we have an enemy of a certain kind, first principle doesn't tell us whether we should bomb it, invade it, not trade with it more, infiltrate. I mean, there's lots of different kinds of options. And on the law, that you can't draw a clear line of, well, if you only, like the War Powers Act tries to do, if you're only engaged for a certain amount of time, you're okay. Or as certain legalisms have been involved over the years, whether President Obama's kinetic military action, which is not engaging in war and therefore doesn't have to qualify with the War Powers Act, or President Truman's police action in Korea. No, not war. I don't want to ask Congress for a declaration of war. This is just a mere police action. Trying to use such euphemisms undermines the rule of law. Call a spade a spade. Say that you're using the military for such and such a purpose. Consult with Congress. Get a resolution of authorization that would help politically and as a matter of legitimacy. And for that matter, if Congress disagrees with what the president is doing, whatever, wherever that might be, then Congress should be more active with resolutions of disapproval and cutting off funds, not altogether to the Department of Defense, but for specific actions. Congress did that during the end of the Vietnam War very well. You know, you cannot use funding to do such and such and such. That's a perfectly appropriate role for Congress to partake in. And so I'm sorry I don't have any clear, bright lines for you in this area. I don't think they exist. The foreign policy power is constitutionally, other than those exemptions that I read out, left to the executive. But that doesn't mean that Congress can't be more vigorous in reasserting its institutional prerogative in this area as in others.
Professor Rapkin.
Congressman Gallagher's little forays into history and his talk, particularly talking about Senator La Follette in 1917, reminded me of an episode in that same debate, should we go to war with Germany? The first woman in Congress, Jeanette Rankin, they actually had a roll call. They called the names and they got to her, and she stood up and she said, it's a very serious thing to take the nation to war. We can have tens of thousands of casualties. It can disrupt our economy. More than that, the honor of the United States is at stake. We should only do this for the most urgent reasons. You should get a long speech. And at the end of it, the clerk of the House said, do you want me to record that as no or yes? I agree with my fellow panelists. At a certain point, you just have to decide what's the best thing to do, and very abstract doctrines are not going to help you that much. If you're thinking about like doctrines regarding international affairs or foreign policy, I will go further and say I think it's pretty clear from the Constitution that the founders, and it's one of the reasons why their work has lasted so long, they were modest about how much they could settle. So they left a lot open, particularly in regard to foreign policy, but not everything. I again want to follow the congressman's example and cite local heroes. Mine, of course, is George Mason. I mean, he's not really my hero, but I feel in some way that he pays my salary. And at the Constitutional Convention, one of George Mason's contributions was to keep saying, wait, what do you mean you can affirm a treaty by two-thirds? That makes it too easy to affirm a treaty. It should be at least three-quarters. And he was, as probably you recall, the person who said, no, I can't support the Constitution because it doesn't have a Bill of Rights. So then they said, all right, we'll ask people to suggest amendments. And quite a lot of states suggested amendments. And one of the most popular ones was two-thirds is too low a majority for a treaty. It should be at least three-quarters. I mention that because if you're interested in American exceptionalism, which is kind of like the doorway to America First as a slogan, or maybe the euphemism for America First, but how are we exceptional today? I agree with Henry Now. Of course, there's a lot of democracies out there. One way in which we are indisputably exceptional is we're one of the very few countries in which our diplomats can go out and negotiate a treaty and say it's okay and even maybe sign something, and then it's not ratified. Because it turns out that in spite of George Mason and other people, two-thirds is a really high barrier. We are exceptional in the world in not automatically committing to a treaty just because the president, who is our chief diplomat, thinks we should. Now, you might say that shows that we, from the beginning, have been kind of skeptical about international commitments. That's one way of viewing it. And of course, there's some truth to that. They were afraid of bad treaties. But the other way of looking at it, which I think there's a lot of justification for it, if you look at debates in the founding era, they thought commitments were serious. And they thought, particularly in the 18th century, we can't just go around, signing things and then saying, I'm Frederick the Great. I don't care about that. Because we really need to maintain our credit because we're vulnerable and we need to have people trust us. So I think there's a way in which we have taken international commitments as seriously as any other country and in some ways perhaps more seriously. We make it difficult to commit and then we take it rather seriously. One indication of that even now is how unbelievably lawyered we are. Our Defense Department has many thousands of lawyers to work through. Is this consent, not just with domestic law, but also with international law? This is something they teach at West Point. We're really, in a way, more serious, if not to the spirit, at least to the details which we can work our way through and work our way around on international law. And I think that that is not a bad thing. You can overdo it, but I think that's not a bad orientation towards the world because it is saying we expect to have an orderly world. We look forward to an orderly world. We do not think chaos is good because we'll be strong enough to benefit by the chaos. I mean, I think that's a good disposition to start with, that you want an orderly world. So I want, in my very brief period before I get indicted or whatever it is happens to you, actually, professors never get indicted.
True.
I mean, the worst thing that happens is you get a bad book review. And most professors are thrilled that anyway someone noticed the book. let me just give...
I'm surprised you haven't been protested yet, actually.
My co-author, John Yu, has that. He has a lot. Let me just mention three things that seem to me potentially relevant issues. And the first one is, since we're talking about treaties, I think it's a question how we renounce them. NAFTA and the WTO agreements are not actually, they weren't presented as treaties, but they were approved by the House and the Senate in pretty formal, solemn commitments, and even that procedure, which isn't in the Constitution, is something that we started doing in the mid-19th century, so there's a lot of history behind it, I think, and most scholars say, oh yes, that is the equivalent of a treaty, that is a very serious commitment. It shouldn't be that easy to just say, okay, we repudiate it. I personally find it really startling and disturbing that the president keeps saying, if I'm not satisfied with NAFTA, I'll repudiate it. I can't understand the legal theory on which it is up to the president to do that unilaterally. It's not, there is provision in NAFTA for saying you want to withdraw, but just to have the president do that on his own is really startling, and it really shifts the whole responsibility for major commitments like that. So that's one example. I would say on the other side, there's not much danger of this now, but let's say over the past 20 years, there's a question about what can be a treaty. And maybe the two-thirds is a pretty high hurdle, but it seems to me beyond the two-thirds, there ought to be some understanding of what can be a treaty. Because if anything can be a treaty, if, for example, we decide that we want to join the... I was going to take the extreme case of the European Court of Human Rights, which Russia is a member of, so... I don't think you need very high credentials to join that. It's not even clear you need to be in Europe to join that. So then a whole range of domestic issues would be subject to decision by this court. Now, it's true it doesn't necessarily take direct effect in U.S. law, but if you could have the whole range of domestic things that domestic disputes and issues that now come under the rubric of human rights decided by an outside court, then it seems to me we have really decided that we can have an alternate constitution next to the original constitution, because we can make all kinds of things subject to federal determination, because that's really what it's doing. If you say it's now international, Congress has the authority to implement treaties. That has not been discussed in a long time. Even in the Bond case, there's only two justices that say, wait, it's a little disturbing to think that anything could be a treaty. I think it would be good to revive that debate, because...
Medellin's probably more relevant.
So there's a number of cases in which there's been a discussion about this. Where I was going to go to next is, I think it can't be right that our Constitution allows us to participate in the International Criminal Court and have people subject by the consent of Congress to something that is completely outside the constitutional framework just because it would make people happy in Europe or someplace else. Yes, we make international commitments, take them seriously, but we're not completely open in what we can commit to, and the Constitution puts some important constraints on that. Let me just say a last thing, since the discussion previously has been about resort to force. I think it cannot be true that we can, by treaty, constrain our right to defend ourselves. There are people who view the UN Charter as we can only use force when attacked, which is a certainly plausible reading of the actual language, but it cannot, either that cannot be what it means, or if that's what it means, it cannot be binding on us, because it cannot be that we have this inherent right of self-defense But we can give it up. It says that in the charter. But we can give it up or make it subject to the determination of others when we exercise this inherent right. And I am fortified in that view. And now I'll just recur again to the good old days when Senator La Follette was still the original Senator La Follette in the Senate. There was a debate about the Kellogg-Briand Pact, renouncing the use of force for offensive purposes. And somebody asked Secretary Kellogg, it was probably someone put up to it by Senator La Follette, what does it mean, offensive uses of force? And he said, well, of course, there is an inherent right of self-defense, and that cannot be taken away because it is inherent. But it wouldn't be helpful to try to formulate a precise definition because every country has to decide that for itself. And I think that actually he had a good hold on what was the Lockean doctrine, the original natural law doctrine. Perhaps we don't need to bring this up in the era of President Trump, but I think it's good for us to hold on to this from the 18th century that we want to have an orderly world. We want to make commitments that mean something, but there's a limit to what we can commit to, both for domestic constitutional reasons and also for this most fundamental reason that there's a right of self-defense, which you have to hold on to. It is not always obvious when that right of self-defense would be engaged. So just to give one example in closing, I don't know what to do about the Iranian nuclear program. Good luck to the people grappling with this. I don't know what to do about Kim Jong-un, supposing that he's not totally charmed by President Trump at that summit. I think it cannot be right that we have
I think Trump should use Kim Kardashian as an envoy instead of Dennis Rodman. No, instead of Dennis Rodman.
So I don't do, you know, details, right? I just do the theory, but it cannot be right that we can only defend ourselves against nuclear attack after they have committed a nuclear attack on us. Thank you.
Well, thank you, gentlemen. Professor Now, would you like an opportunity to offer some further reflections or
Maybe responses? Just quickly. I mean, I'm as concerned, I think, as both Ilya and Jeremy are about the growth of executive power and particularly the growth of power in our defense and intelligence communities, to be quite honest, because, you know, this was one of the concerns when we established the Republic, that is, we understood that war was not good for civil rights. And so we need to think about, we need to do something about that, it seems to me. On the other hand, I'm also aware of the fact that we live in a very different world now than we did 200 years ago, not just politically in terms of lots of democracies, but also technologically. And you have a nuclear world, and somehow or other that has concentrated a lot of power in the office of the president. And I'm not sure you want to, and as long as the world does remain nuclear, that you want to constrain that ability on the part of the president to react, you know, fairly quickly to events. I'm talking about military events. So it is a quandary, but I'm very sympathetic to the need to try to bring executive power, the power of the presidency, and most importantly, the power of the bureaucracy under some greater degree of accountability. And I'm a hawk. I'm saying that as a hawk. So I think it's the problem is worth looking at.
Ilya, any?
I'm curious to see what people are interested in the audience. Oh, there is one thing I'll add that I should have mentioned in my example of where Congress could assert itself, and that Congressman Gallagher touched on that, and that's the area of trade. Why don't he and Ben Sasse and whoever else is rightly critical of these tariffs do something, even if it's to have a losing vote? I think that would be play a productive role in our debate.
And in particular, to question, how can it be an exercise of a power given for national security? There's this national security category, which you can impose tariffs for national security, and the national security policy is to antagonize our two immediate neighbors and our closest long-term allies. But you maybe had a different question.
Maybe. Thank you for your remarks. We all appreciate it. My question deals with the difference between treaties on the one hand and international commitments that don't rise to that level. And I'd ask that you perhaps use the use of such agreements by the last administration as a point of departure. What steps should be taken, if any, to have more entanglements be subject to a treaty? What can be done? Is it a political question? It's a broad question for you all to comment on, because I don't think we've explicitly done so thus far.
I actually have. Can I start? So, I was very interested in this and testified about it in the previous administration, where President Obama said, we're going to commit to the Paris Accords because I said so. You know, it's the Obama ratification. And we're going to have this agreement with Iran because I said so. Now, in both those cases, the other parties, you know, they learned a lesson from the failure of the League of Nations or of the Versailles Treaty in the Senate. They did know this, that, in America, you need to have the Senate. So they did know that this was not optimal. In fact, it's not only suboptimal, it's close to meaningless. Because it cannot be that the
virtue signaling.
Yes, it cannot be that the president signs his name and then the United States is committed on a really fundamental matter. I get it, there's executive agreements on a lot of secondary things, but it should be either pursuant to a treaty or pursuant to legislation, or so modest that you'd have to be really churlish to go back on it just to show, like, ha, I'm untrustworthy, I want you to know it. But on a major policy dispute, like what are we going to do with the Iranian nuclear program, or what are we going to do about carbon emissions, to have the president on his own unilaterally decide that, I think the world should understand, and actually I think they do understand, I think they do know, that that isn't worth very much. That's one notch above Jared and Ivanka saying, like, yeah, we think that would be good. I mean, that's just, or I forgot their names already. Somebody in, what were the Obama children?
Sasha and Malia,
right? I mean, this the president doesn't have the authority to do this. And, I think it would actually be good for the Congress to pass a resolution just saying, you're expressing your opinions, we're expressing our opinions. It's not a law, it's just a resolution. The Senate could do this. And actually, it would be good for the Senate to do this because they're the ones most directly challenged by this. Just pass a non-binding resolution. It would be non-binding.
Well, we
do not regard ourselves in the Senate as bound by this. So, in any future debate, we will not be influenced by the argument that the president promised, because in our view, that's a campaign speech.
Although the president's promise is worth more if it's regarding things in the foreign affairs arena over which the executive has more power. So the Paris Accords, the reason why that promise wasn't worth much is because it would have required legislation from Congress to have all sorts of regulations and restrictions and whatnot. This is not a commitment to preserve the security of NATO or anything else, or decision to move an embassy or things that are clearly foreign affairs and left to the president. So it's kind of related to the discussion about a self-executing treaty versus non-self-executing that requires further congressional authorization. But I think our foreign interlocutors are increasingly aware of the nuances of our system.
Next question.
Thank you. Let me pick up the issue of trade. I'm in the investment business, and there is a great deal of interest in this subject. So, Mr. Now, as I understand your position, as you went through the history of trade agreements, you're suggesting that this was part of how the U.S. put together the global order, the global world order, an extension of our foreign policy, an extension of U.S. influence, and in a kind of indirect sense, also to guarantee our national security, or at least to shore it up, in effect, inducing countries to come into that order by opening our markets and producing a system where, in effect, it was not a reciprocal balance of trade, but effectively part of these other inducements. Now, if that is true and coincident with what you're saying, slightly in contrast to how Mr. Rabkin views the world, it seems to me that is exactly what the Trump administration is saying as well. Now, from there, it appears to me that you differ on the outcome from that. Trump is saying, okay, enough is enough. That just like the defense commitments, that was then, now we have to roll this back. Doesn't influence the correctness of that judgment. The people are screaming. People always scream when they lose something. You're in effect saying, no, this is quite valuable and we want to keep that old system, or at least not push it too hard. This is just a policy question, not a legal question. Do you think that characterizes the current state of play?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, look, the jury is still out on the trade issue. It's not clear that we are threatening to leave the NAFTA and possibly some aspects of the WTO. But is that a bargaining tool? And if you're going to make some changes in existing agreements, you're going to need some leverage, and you're going to need some bargaining leverage. Or, you know, could we accept that outcome? That is an outcome in which we would withdraw from NAFTA. I'm hoping it's a negotiating tactic. Now, obviously, to make the other side believe that you might withdraw enhances your leverage. But I'm waiting to see. I think in the next 6 months we'll have a better idea of whether these are real threats or whether, in fact, it's part of negotiating. Negotiating a rebalancing, by the way, of trade arrangements among the major industrialized democratic countries, which, as you pointed out, were developed in a period where the United States was predominant. We followed a strategy to try to actually create competitors, and hopefully they would be happy and satisfied and prosperous competitors and become more democratic, and that's worked brilliantly. Now we have to contend with the results of that, which is that we are part of a democratic community in which our relative power has declined, and the allies have to take on more responsibilities. And I see Trump in his way, in his style, which I don't particularly approve of, I see him trying to rebalance both the security and the trade commitments on the part of the allies. Look, you guys do more. We'll take care of our Article 5, but you make sure you take care of yours. Trade, same way. I think he's got the wrong view about trade. As I suggested, he's focused on, like a nationalist is, on the win-lose part of trade rather than the overall winning aspect of trade. But look, if you're going to rebalance some of these relationships, you're going to have to break some eggs. And that's what Trump is doing. I mean, other presidents were they spouted the words, but they didn't do anything to get the attention of the European leaders. When Trump left Europe last year, there was a wonderful quote by Angela Merkel. And it told me that the Europeans are getting the message. She said, we can't depend as much as we used to on the American commitment. We're going to have to do more ourselves. Well, wow, she didn't say we were leaving Europe, and Trump didn't leave the impression that we were leaving NATO. But, you know, she was a little worried about, we can't rely on them as much as we have in the past. We better get our act together this time around. I think that's the message that he, and, you know, it's making some, at least in the security area, we're making some progress. Something like 8 countries now in NATO, as opposed to 3, are going to meet their defense commitments. Now, you know, that's just one rough measure, but I hope he keeps that pressure up, because the allies can do more. They must do more. Japan is doing a lot more in Asia. I mean, there may be the model that we should, you know, hold up.
The gentleman here in the front.
On a subject that has been mentioned by the panelists, on Thursday or Friday, OLC issued released an opinion on the president's power to use force. And this OLC opinion, I think, is quite remarkable for 3 reasons. First, it's the first Trump OLC pronouncement on the subject. The second, to use Jack Goldsmith's phraseology, it brings out of the shadows a few of the heretofore closeted Obama positions, which sound very much like something that could have been formulated under W or Reagan or even Bush 41. And I think while I have a little bit of a concern as to whether or not they go a bit too far, It is it's quite interesting how expressive it is and how much support they get from heretofore undisclosed Obama positions. But the thing that disturbed me was that it basically says that there are two tests for presidential power and the use of force. One is whether or not it's in the interests of there is a national interest, which I think is a little loosey-goosey. But the second says it depends on whether or not what the president is proposing is a war. And that's fine to throw that in a situation where it clearly isn't, quote, a war. But it seems to me that the OLC has basically, on the basis of, I think, quite weak precedents, substituted the make for declare. And as we know, it's been referred the founders rejected the making war formulation and went for declare. And the thing that was disappointing is that declare war is a sort of a legal concept. It's in the same category, it's in the same clause as letters of marque and reprisal and the question of captures on land and water, which doesn't mean, in my view, whether or not you can send somebody to Guantanamo, but it really goes to what you can do with the ship that you have captured, the military assets that you have captured. So, I fear this is a trap that will come back to haunt a future administration. Stuart Gerson here and I were both in the Bush 41 when Judge Green, in the case that that Stuart argued unsuccessfully, but given who the judge was, I don't hold it against him. Basically, what Judge Green said was, of course, President Bush has to go to Congress because he's doing is a war. He was calling up 500,000 troops and so forth. This in connection with the first Gulf War. Anyway, so I'll put a question mark at the end of this and stop my commentary.
Well, I'm not familiar. When did this latest OLC opinion come out?
Thursday, and it deals with the April bombing in Syria.
I was in Australia, that's why I missed it, yeah. I'm just glad I didn't fall off. You know? I look forward to reading that. That's interesting. Look, to the extent this relates to, at all, to the War Powers Act, and it seems like there's some resonance there. I sort of think that the War Powers Act might lay out certain prudential things to keep in mind, but I can't see how it's necessarily binding on the executive. If it's national interest and whether the president is making proposing a war, those sound like valid considerations. But again, so much of this is based in prudence. I think it's an area where we can, an area that's an opportunity to decrease the lawyering that we have. That's as much as I can say without having read the opinion.
I just read about it, but that's the next best thing. And it resonates with
me. That's like your last book. I just read a review.
Did it? Was it good? The OLC opinion about the Libya intervention was kind of squishy, and there was a suggestion there that, well, it's kind of okay because it's helping to implement a Security Council policy, and it's part of our national interest to maintain the prestige of the Security Council. And I was kind of taken aback by that because that really leads you potentially very far away from the national security of the United States. This intervention in Syria, the retaliation for the use of poison gas, I think that's a very big question. Or maybe it even is not a big question. Maybe it's like obvious that that is not by itself. Someone violated a treaty commitment
in regard to third parties, but it had no direct effect on us. I don't know why that is a authority for the president to use force. And I deplore doctrines that make it too easy for the president to deploy, real military force where things get blown up and people get killed without some tether that goes back in a pretty direct and concrete way to the actual security of the United States. But of course, I agree with Ilya that it's very hard to draw sharp, clear, neat lines here, and reasonable people could reasonably disagree about how I'm not sure they could really reasonably argue it with regard to the poison gas thing in Syria, but in many other situations, people could be on both sides of these things.
And certainly it shouldn't depend, either the legitimacy, legality, or anything else shouldn't, or wisdom shouldn't depend on whether you get the correct semantic definition of war versus kinetic action versus police action versus, you know, whatever else.
It would be, I mean, this may be naive, it very well may be, but I regret that Congress did not at least have a debate about this, because a debate is a way of putting the president on notice that we're paying attention and we are disturbed. And even though there may be no immediate efforts on our part to sanction you for this, you should know that you're on really thin ice and we are very troubled by this, so you shouldn't treat this as a really secure precedent. I say it's naive because maybe once you open up a debate like that, it gets out of control and it becomes confusing, and then people have to rush in to defend the president and it doesn't have a clear message. But I think it was probably worth trying, and so I regret that the Senate didn't think that they should schedule time for a debate about that. I think you are raising a very serious issue there.
Gentlemen, we're right up on time. We have time for just a very brief question and then maybe a parting shots or concluding thoughts from our panelists.
Hi, Janice Wolk, Grenadier, entrepreneur. I think that China is our issue. We have a lawsuit right now in the state of Virginia against Governor Terry McAuliffe, 32 Chinese people who were promised under the EB-5, I believe it is, by investing $500,000 each into one of his companies, they would get citizenship. We have 130,000 that was donated to his campaign where he stated, don't know who did it. Well, he introduced them to the Clintons. We have where they've bought the Waldorf Astoria. In Korea, and we're negotiating with him, all of a sudden he goes to China and our negotiations have issues. So is China, and as an entrepreneur, I had a product. I couldn't get funding because I wouldn't have it made in China because it would only cost, I would only save 50 cents in China. And I wanted it made here in the United States. And investors were like, oh no, we need that 50 cents. We didn't need it. So how and why are we not educating American people on paying a little bit more if that's what it's going to take to keep the investment here? And how is China really one of our biggest frights, especially as they're taking over islands?
I'll answer the question just briefly and drawing on, you know, what's just been discussed, which is not in my wheelhouse as a non-lawyer. I mean, we talk a lot about when we can use force, when the president is allowed to use force, and all these issues have to do with that. I'm much more concerned about for what purpose does the president use force. And this relates to the question of what are our priorities? Where are the real threats in the world? I mean, my own view is that Libya at the time of the Libyan intervention was much less important in terms of our vital interests than Syria, for example, or Iraq. Syria and Iraq are much less important, in my view, than Ukraine, because Ukraine could destabilize the border of a Europe that is whole and free. Similarly, China. I mean, I'm much more concerned about the Korean Peninsula than almost any other issue in Asia, because that's the issue that could really reverberate against the foothold now that democracy has in Asia. So we need to kind of We do. I mean, we need to deal with all of the, and I'm going to say this in a room full of lawyers, I know, and you're not going to like me, but I mean, we need to deal with the legal aspects of this, but we also need to elevate the discussion at some point to the level of strategy and priorities and to critique presidential actions on that basis, not just on the basis of whether or not, you know, the authority is clear in the legislation or do we need to make it clearer, and so on.
I just want to add to that one exception to what Henry said before about, you know, we designed this international trade system with the idea of building up countries that would then be our friends, and he said that was a brilliant success. Not with China, it wasn't.
That's it.
Right?
China's a different country today than it was 30 years ago, though.
Yes, and it's in some ways a more dangerous nation today than it was 30 years ago, right? We helped to build up a country which does not seem to be inclined to be a reliable partner. That's a very, very big challenge. I think that really ought to be our highest priority in foreign affairs or among the top two or three. I'll just say, I'm not sure of this, but my inclination is you don't want to frame that in as an abstract concern about trade. Because we don't actually have a big problem with Canada and Mexico or even with Germany. And we don't have a strategic problem. Maybe we could renegotiate NAFTA advantageously. Maybe we want to make some changes in our trade relations with Europe. But that's a completely different order of concern from China. And it's really regrettable if our concerns about China get subsumed in abstractions about, trade is not working to our advantage, which is, at that level of abstraction, I don't think has any real meaning. I mean, it's just grousing, I think. But anyway, China, yes, you're right to put that on the table, and we should focus and be more serious about that.
This is dangerous. Mr. Shapiro gets the final word.
I don't think I have anything to add to that. I mean, I'm not familiar with this lawsuit. If there's some aspect of public corruption or pay for play or something, that of course needs to be negotiated. There's not anything wrong in theory with auctioning off or selling off green cards at a high rate to bring in revenue or what have you. I mean, that's part of a larger discussion on immigration reform rather than either foreign policy or trade. I don't really have anything either intelligent or funny to conclude with. I'm sorry to disappoint.
Well, it's been excellent, and we want to thank all of you for coming to join us today. We want to thank Henry, Ilya, and Jeremy for their insightful remarks. If you'd like to learn more about the Federal Society's Federalism and Separation of Powers Practice Group, please visit the website. Same with the Article One Initiative. Please give our excellent panelists a round of applause.
Thank you for listening to Necessary and Proper. If you enjoyed this podcast, please tell a friend, and don't forget to subscribe on iTunes or Google Play. To learn more about the Article One Initiative, please visit fedsoc.org/articlei. That's fedsoc.org/articlei.
This has been a FedSoc audio production.